2000, and we're in the Strauss Press Room at the Bancroft Library. Eleanor Swent continuing an interview with Robert Shoemaker. This is interview number 4, take 10. The date on this is June 9th, 2000. Something's going on. What are we getting? Oh, it was the in business. Our last interview was in December, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
That's quite a while ago. So we're resuming here. We're in the Strauss Room again, and you had some more consulting jobs that we wanted to talk about.
The first one I want to talk about was Chimney Creek, which was 50 miles north and east of Winnemucca, and owned by Goldfields, who I had consulted for a total of about 15 or 17 years. This was a gold mill, 2,000 tons a day, and there was no electric power up there. It was about 7 or 8 miles farther north than the old, I'll think of the name in a minute, mine that Newmont had an interest in many years ago. And that power line was not sufficient to supply power for Chimney Creek. But the Chimney Creek was about 24 miles in a direct line to the Valmy, V-A-L-M-Y, power plant that was owned by Sierra Pacific. And it was, you could actually see the power plant, which is alongside of Highway 80. And it was a coal-fired power plant. And when the Goldfields contacted the Sierra Pacific, they wanted an outrageous amount of money for running the power line and putting in new transformers, and the total cost would have been somewhere around 9 cents a kilowatt hour. Mm-hmm. So Stan Burns, who was their electrical consultant, he got a hold of Harney Electric, H-A-R-N-E-Y, which was a rural electrification administration power company up in Oregon. And they got their power from Bonneville Power. And they gave a quote which was a couple of cents cheaper than Sierra Pacific quote.
Even though it was much farther away.
Yes. And Sierra Pacific then wrote Goldfields a letter and said that if Goldfields bought power from Harney Electric, that Sierra Pacific would sue because they claimed Goldfields' plant was in their sphere of influence, and that this would hold up the construction of the plant by at least a year or maybe more. And so Stan Burns, who's a very good friend of mine, he had a good idea, and there was a gas line that ran along Highway 80, and he got a hold of the gas company and got them to quote on supplying gas to the plant, and he priced out a set of...
That is gas to the... Chimney Creek plant.
Chimney Creek plant.
Right.
And it would have been been a 24-mile pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
And he priced out a gas diesel power plant. There were four gas diesel engines in it, and it turned out that all in all, not only the construction of the pipeline and the construction of the diesel plant and the cost of the gas, it all came out to another 2 cents saving. Mm-hmm. So they got their power for 5 cents and said to Sierra Pacific, heck with you. And mm-hmm. Sierra Pacific couldn't do a thing about it. Sierra Pacific was just trying to hold them up,
mm-hmm.
and which was really highly unethical, but mm-hmm. it's, some corporations are like that. And
is this unusual to have a gas diesel plant?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of plants have diesel plants, and a lot of mills have diesel plants, but not particularly in the United States, because mm-hmm. there's so much power available, but in other Canada and other mm-hmm. countries too.
But the combination, they got the gas from the gas line, and then they had to bring diesel in some other way?
Diesel with electric generators attached to them. So they generated their own power.
But where did they get the diesel fuel?
No, these were diesel engines, in other words.
Oh, diesel engines.
Not like a gasoline engine.
Okay, I was thinking powered by diesel oil.
No, they were powered by gas.
Powered by the gas.
But it was still a diesel engine.
But it was a diesel engine, okay.
And so they ran along for several years that way. And then Santa Fe Pacific, which was Santa Fe Railroad and who took over Southern Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
They found a deposit just about a mile south of Chimney Creek on their own property. This is the old railroad checkerboard,
mm-hmm.
you know, that they got every other square mile way back in the 1860s.
Yeah.
For I think 20 miles on either side of the railroad for that they built. Anyway, they found this deposit and
of coal.
No, it was gold.
Oh, okay.
And so they decided to build a gold plant.
Mm.
And then when they contacted Sierra Pacific, Sierra Pacific had a lesson, and they brought their power price down to where they could, where it equaled the cost that was incurred by, or equal the price that the gold fields was paying for their gas diesel power. And eventually, Goldfields was sold, and it was sold to Santa
Chimney
Fe.
Chimney Creek, that is.
Pardon?
Chimney Creek. Or
Chimney Creek was sold to
yeah.
Santa Fe, and then the Chimney Creek plant was connected up to the Sierra Pacific power line, and they sold the gas diesel plant for more than it cost them. And it's kind of amusing that Sierra Pacific Power was taught a lesson and at their expense.
Now, who do you sell a power plant to?
Oh, I don't know who bought it, but some company that was not near a power line or that wanted some standby power. Bought it, and it was kept in perfect condition. It was just like new. Nothing ever goes well. The pistons and the cylinders have sleeves in them, and so you just replace, when it gets worn, you replace the sleeve. You don't have to replace the whole engine. Mm-hmm. And bearings are replaceable, and so it was a beautiful power plant.
Mm-hmm.
And it just ran like a clock.
Well, did you do the metallurgical work there?
Yes, I did all the metallurgical work, because I was in effect their Goldfield staff metallurgist. They never had one.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took that place and was in charge of all of their research on all of their prospects, and including, I did the same with Mesquite down in Southern California, their heap leach, and then other of their prospects that weren't developed.
Was there anything special about Chimney Creek?
It was probably the best designed gold plant that's probably ever been built. Goldfields kept their plant manager, the mine superintendent, the mill superintendent, the chief metallurgist, and the maintenance superintendent at the Davy McKee offices over in the other side.
San Ramon.
San Ramon. And I was over there every week, and Bob Thurmond, their consulting mining engineer, was there, and so was Stan Burns, the electrical consultant.
This is during the construction?
During the design.
And
so we very, very closely supervised the engineering firm, Davy McKee. And these were all operating people that we had, mm-hmm. and it turned out to be the prettiest plant. There's one, thing about the Chimney Creek. At one time, before it had been sold to Goldfields itself, Consolidated Goldfields of London was the owner, but they owned Goldfields USA, and they were bought by a very large English conglomerate. But before they bought, that conglomerate bought Goldfields, and later sold Goldfields USA to Sierra Pacific,
Santa Fe
Pacific. Newmont took a run at Goldfields, and I got a call from Bill Brown, who was the president, and he told me
president
that...
President of Goldfields.
President of Goldfields, and he asked me to charter a plane and come over to Chimney Creek the next morning to take the Newmont metallurgists around the plant. They sent a team of metallurgists and a team of mining people and geologists, and Bill didn't want his people taking these Newmont people around. So Bob Thurmond came up and took all the mining and exploration people around the mine. And the metallurgists were headed up by a young fellow by the name of Comadina, K-O-M-A-D-I-N-A, whose father was quite a famous metallurgist. His name was George, and he had been chief metallurgist at the Sierrita plant, which was owned by one of the oil companies. It was a copper plant, very large, south of Tucson. And Jim Comadina, I had known casually, and he was he was full of himself. Mm-hmm. And we started out at the primary crusher, and this was a very nicely designed crusher, and it was kept just spotlessly clean, and it looked like it cost a lot of money, but it didn't. It was just a very good design. And Comadina, after we finished the tour and went back into the office in the conference room to talk about it, he says, "Why did you build such an expensive primary crushing plant?" And I said, "Well, there was one reason." I said, "We didn't want to build a complete abortion like you people put in over at Gold Quarry," which was the Newmont's big plant that's over there. And that was, he was very angry, but he finally got calmed down. The primary crusher at Gold Quarry was just terrible. It isn't even worth looking at describing. It was so bad. And he didn't like it.
It would seem to me that after all these decades of crushing, that designing a primary crusher would be more or less standard.
Well, what
can you do?
Still make the same mistakes over and over again. And there's not very many people that really ask questions and take advantage of other people's experience.
What are the variables in a crusher that make it so tricky?
Well, this one at Gold Quarry, they put in a jaw crusher, which was smaller than it should have been, and they had to...
Now, what does that, because of the size of or roughness of the rock, or the quantity that they wanted to put through, or...?
Well, it was partly both, but a jaw crusher has to be fed by an apron feeder. You can't just dump a truckload of rock into a jaw crusher like you can with a gyratory. And they put in a a grizzly in the bottom of the dump pocket. This is a large stationary screen, you might say, with openings that were, say, 3 feet square or 4 feet square. And the dump pocket was, and had this apron feeder underneath it that fed the jaw crusher. Well, first of all, it fed a vibrating grizzly that took out the finer material, and then the oversized went into the jaw crusher. The dump pocket was very deep. It was about, 25 feet deep. And they were using 150-ton truck to dump into it. And when the truck got its bed elevated during the dump, the total drop into that grizzly was close to 50 feet.
Mm.
dumping boulders that were 4 and 5 feet in diameter. The grizzly just sagged in the middle, and sagged so badly that it had to be rebuilt about 3 times during the first couple of months of operation. And then below that, there was another long, 75-foot-long apron conveyor, and it had to be a steel apron conveyor because the undersized rock was from the grizzly was dropping quite a distance. It couldn't drop on a rubber belt. And anyway, the whole thing was about 100 feet high. And it was built into a hole, and the it was almost a conical or half of a conical hole with very steep sides, and they started this up in the wintertime, and during the first week of operation, a maintenance truck went down this slope to do something, maintain something, and the slope was icy, and the truck just slid. They couldn't stop it, and it collided with the electrical transformer, and the transformer, of course, was smashed, and so was the truck, and it shut the plant down for about a week until I could get a new transformer. It was just a poor design all the way through.
Oh, I interrupted you. You said the jaw crusher was too small.
They replaced it after after a couple of years with a gyratory crusher that was built more along conventional lines.
Mm-hmm.
And that, as I say, people just, well, McQuiston and I wrote this book on primary crushing plant design. And it was, the book outlined all the mistakes that had been made on various crushers and made recommendations for the how one should be designed. And anyway.
So you took your crowd through the Goldfields plant.
Yeah, and we went all through the plant. But anyway, Newmont decided not to buy Goldfield at that time, so. But it was interesting shepherding those people around and answering all their questions.
Did you ever go back, were you ever called back to do anything after it operated?
Well, after it was sold to this Hansen PLC out of England, I only went back there, I think, twice, and then the manager that that Hansen put in, he knew nothing about mining, never been connected with mining before. He just considered this, he said, a mine can be run just like any other business. And anyway, he didn't want to pay a consultant, so he told Bob Thurman and I that we weren't needed anymore. So I never went back. And then later on, of course, Santa Fe was sold to, Santa Fe bought it, and then Santa Fe was absorbed by Newmont. So Newmont
eventually got it. Now, Hansen is spelled with an E-N or O-N-E-N.
E-N,
yeah.
One of the people, the vice president of finance for Goldfields, was named Tony Cialli, C-I-A-L-L-I, and he Jackson took over Goldfields, well, they had no, they put in their own people, so he lost his job. And somehow he got, well, he knew some of the, he knew the Goldfields, Consolidated Goldfields board of directors in London. And one of those had an interest in a consortium of financiers that somehow had been, got a hold of a prospect, a gold prospect in Venezuela. And they had, they made Tony a vice president, and he lived in New Jersey, and they built a gold plant in Venezuela, and it was built by, designed and built by Bateman Engineering out of South Africa, and the Bateman construction manager was then hired to, as manager of the plant. He was a construction man and didn't know anything about running a plant, and they had, this consortium had hired no consultants to look over Bateman's shoulder, and the plant was it just didn't run very well. It was just full of faults.
What sort of plant was it?
It was a gold plant.
What kind of processing?
It was a cyanidation plant,
mm-hmm.
And it was built to.
Excuse me. We didn't find out, what was the Chimney Creek? That was a heap leach?
Chimney Creek was a milling plant, and milling and cyanidation.
Cyanidation. And
Mesquite operation was a heap leach.
Yeah, you mentioned that, but I didn't, okay. So this one in Venezuela was a?
It was a gold plant,
uh-huh.
It was a milling plant.
Okay.
And used carbon and pulp processing.
Mm-hmm.
And the ore body was actually not a in situ ore body. It was tailings from a whole bunch of little independent miners that had been mining in this area for a long, long time, and they dumped their tailings into a very small creek, and as it came into this valley, well, the tailings spread out, and they were 20 feet thick there for quite a ways.
Where is this located?
It was to the west of Lima, or not Lima, but
Caracas,
and it was over near the British Guiana, or what is called Guiana now. Border. You had to fly down to fly west to a city, I can't remember the name of it, which had a couple of big aluminum plants, and then drive a long, long distance. But anyway, these tailings had some gold in them, supposedly, and although they were, and Bateman had done the test work, and based on Bateman's test work, they put in the plant, but it turned out that the tailings were much lower grade than the samples that Bateman had taken. They did a poor sampling job, and the plant was very poorly designed, and it was very inefficient. They weren't making recovery, even if the gold had been what they thought it was. And in addition, this manager was, his name was John Brownlee, B-R-O-W-N-L-E-E. He was a Scotsman, and he talked continuously. You couldn't interrupt him. But he was he was on the take. It turned out that he had gotten kickbacks from every subcontractor that was engaged to build the plant, and it turned out that that he was also getting kickbacks from the independent truckers that were excavating these tailings, and he also had the chief chemist falsify the assays and increase the assays of the load, each load on the truck. And but anyway, Tony,
how do you find out this kind of thing? Just a sec. When you come into a place as a consultant, how do you find out this sort of thing?
I'll get to that
okay.
in just a minute.
All right.
anyway, Tony Cialli asked Bill Brown, who had been president of Goldfield U.S., and Bob Thurman and I to go down and take a look at this plant. And we were pretty well horrified at everything that was going on, and they didn't have a mill superintendent. Brownlee was a, had a foreman is all who didn't really know. He was a Venezuelan, and he'd worked in mills, but there, he wasn't really very experienced. And so we told Cialli that he had to get a competent mill superintendent, and he agreed under protest. And I, when I came back to the States, got a hold of Joe Young, who was mill superintendent at Homestakes Mill, or had been, up at
McLaughlin.
Mm-hmm. And Joe Young had worked for me when I was at Bechtel. He was Chinese, but he'd been born in the States, and a very good metallurgist. And so he went down there and found all of this out by the mill superintendent. I mean, by working there, and found that the assays were off, and he could found that Brownlee was taking kickbacks, and he also found that there was two or three people had found a way into the refinery. And they would crawl through a couple of electrical ducts and get into the ceiling of the refinery and come down some pipes, and you could see their footmarks on the wall. And stealing gold there. And the company was just not making any money, and this consortium of financiers were had to contribute more and more money and to keep it operating. And then the three of us, Brown, Thurman, and myself, down there again after Joe Young had been there for a couple of months. And we told, and when Joe told us all of this,
he was able to tell you in person. I suppose he couldn't have written a letter.
No.
This is kind of tricky, isn't it?
He had to report to Brownlee.
Yeah.
And when you report to a crook, well.
Mm-hmm. You have problems.
But he told me all of this, and I told Bill and Bob Thurmond, and
What were the circumstances of his telling you?
I went to his house. Mm-hmm. They had a camp in or a company village, you might say. And Joe Young had to confide in somebody because he knew that things were going wrong and it wouldn't do any good to talk to Brownlee.
Mm-hmm.
So we told Charlie that he had to fire Brownlee, and Charlie wouldn't do it. And he did. Brownlee promised to make Joe Young the operating manager, and Brownlee was going to be in charge of building a second mill on another ore deposit, which was 50, 60 miles away. But that never happened, and anyway, after a couple months, Joe Young quit. Eventually, the financiers stopped putting up money, and the plant was sold, and Brownlee was out of job.
What was the name of this operation?
It was called La Camora. LACAMORRA. Mm-hmm. And it is very close to a town called El Callao, which was EL and then CALLAO. It was a sequel to that story. Newmont put in a very large heap leach operation in Kazakhstan, in Russia. And there was an article in one of the mining journals, and it mentioned John Brownlee was there as construction manager, and later on they had a manager, but he was still there doing more construction. And a friend of mine was working for Newmont, and they sent him over there, and I happened to be talking with him one day and asked him how Brownlee was doing, and he was very negative about Brownlee, and he didn't want to say too much, and I said, well, I told him what had happened down in Venezuela, and then he opened up and he said he's doing exactly the same thing in Kazakhstan at the Muruntau plant. That's Murantau, which is one of the largest gold mines in the world, but this was on their low-grade material that had been stockpiled for many, many years. And
this was the same plant that, when I was at Bechtel, I mentioned that the CIA came with photographs taken from the U-2 spy plane, and wanted to know how much production could be put through from in that plant from these. I think we talked about that. And I said, well, to my friend, I said, well, did you tell the Newmont management about this? And he said, yes, but they haven't done anything. And Brownlee is still there. And shortly after that, I was at a AIME meeting, a national meeting, a Society of Mining Engineers meeting. And at the Mining and Metallurgical Society luncheon, the speaker was Ronald Cambrai, C-A-M-B-R-E, who was chairman of Newmont at the time. I had met Cambrai before at the dedication ceremony of the gold quarry operation that we just discussed. And so before the meeting and before the luncheon started, they had cocktails ahead of luncheon time, and I went up to Cambrai and reintroduced myself and asked him if I could have a word with him. And I told him about Brownlee and my experience with Brownlee, who was an absolute crook, and I had also heard that he was doing exactly the same thing in Kazakhstan for Newmont. And he thanked me very much, and there was never anything done about it. Brownlee was there for another year and a half. So these things always puzzle me, how the chairman company could tolerate something like it. The least he could do was investigate, and he never did.
Maybe thought that that was the way of doing business in Russia.
Well, in Russia, you have to pay off a lot of people. That you don't have to, but it makes it easier. But it shouldn't be done, and there are plants being built in Russia which do not do that.
I was just thinking, this is entirely off the, but I was thinking you were talking about this other Chimney Creek that belonged to Goldfields, and Newmont was trying to buy it. Plato Malazimov's father worked for Goldfields in Siberia.
Yes.
Long, 100 years before.
Yes.
Not quite 100, but
they had interest in it.
He managed mine for Goldfields, I think.
Father was a manager of the plant.
Siberia. So that was kind of an interesting connection, that Goldfields and Newmont all through them.
I wanted to talk a little bit about, relate a few instances about theft of gold. the Carlin Mill of Newmont, which was the first mill that, first gold plant that Newmont had built in 30 years. In fact, it was the first plant that had been built in the United States in 30 years. This was in 1964. They had a theft.
out that
they had been, there was a jewelry manufacturer in Chicago that the, and this is at the time when it was illegal to have gold, you know, unless you had a license from the Treasury. And the Treasury people had been keeping their eye on this jewelry manufacturer because they thought he had more gold than he had a right to have. And so they began following the owner, and they followed him to Reno, and he met in Reno a couple of men who turned out, when they started following them, that they were working for Newmont at Carlin. And so they went, the Treasury agents went to J. Macbeth, who was the manager of the plant at the time, and told Macbeth that that there were, some of his people were stealing gold, and he couldn't believe it. But they convinced him, and then they it was turned out that the chief chemist and two of the refinery people were in on it, and the chief chemist was cooking the books, and so that his calculations of how much gold that was supposed to, that was produced was verified by his assays. So he was covering up the theft out of the refinery by that. They were stealing zinc precipitate that they recovered the gold in. And these three fellows had been stealing gold for about a year, and they had stolen, it turned out to be over $1 million. And they had quite a high old time. When they would have a birth, one of them would have a birthday, the other two would arrange with one of the local houses of ill repute there at Carlin to throw a party for this the third guy. And he would have a wild weekend with several women, anyway, they arrested all three of them, and they only got about $40,000 worth of gold, $40,000 back. One of the men had put all of his money in his wife's name somehow, and she got away with it. And there wasn't anything more to recover. And only the chief chemist went to jail, and he was only in jail about 4 months. He later became chief chemist at another plant over in Nevada, and the manager of it told me that he was the most honest fellow in the whole plant.
Oh, really?
He had completely changed his ways, and I knew him, and I talked with him, and I was consulting for this other outfit, and he told me all about it, and that he just lost his head, but he'd never do it again.
Well, that's kind of nice.
But they got Frank McQuiston back over there, and Frank went over the assays of all the blast hole samples, and the chief chemist had not cooked those. He'd only cooked the assays in the mill. So as Frank was able to back calculate from those assays of the blast holes and compare that with what their production was and establish to the insurance company's satisfaction that there was $1 million that they had stolen, and so the insurance company paid Newmont off that $1 million.
You can be insured against?
Pardon?
I'm surprised you could be insured against that kind of thing, but.
Well, they had insurance.
Well, that was smart.
Another one was Battle Mountain Gold. I was hired by Battle Mountain Gold because their chief of security had quit, and some 3 months after he had quit, he came down with a bad case of mercury poisoning. And mercury poisoning can be fatal, of course, but he recovered. He went to the hospital and he did recover. And they had been using amalgamation with mercury in the plant because they had coarse gold. And this man was, the company refused to pay him because they had been taking blood samples from him on a regular basis. Anyone who was in the refinery or around the gold room where the coarse gold was and the amalgamation was taking place was checked on a bi-weekly basis for mercury in the blood. And I've forgotten the figures now, but he had a slightly elevated mercury content, like any of the people that worked there in those areas, but it was way under what the government would say that was dangerous, the EPA and so on. However, when he got the mercury poisoning, they analyzed his blood, and it was about 300 times the allowable limit. Well, the company refused he was on workman's compensation, but he was going to sue the company. And the company didn't want to pay him because when he left, his mercury in his blood was very, very low. And so I went over and I looked at the whole place, and they did have the mercury report. They had high levels of mercury in their blood. And so I told them that they had to get a new retort with much better seals on it, which they did. And then I said, why don't you go, well, I talked to a toxicologist here in San Francisco who knew a lot about mercury, and he verified my thoughts that there was no way that if his mercury level in his blood was normal when he left his job, that 3 months later it could be 300 times more. So I told the company that they'd better go and get a subpoena and take some samples in this man's garage or his house or wherever, which they did, and it turned out that there was all kinds of mercury in his garage. Because he'd been heating this amalgam, you know, on an open gas flame, and that's where he got the mercury poisoning.
He was stealing the amalgam.
And he was stealing gold, stealing amalgam.
Processing it himself at home.
Pardon?
Processing it himself.
Yes, processing it in the garage.
Oh my.
So they, the man couldn't sue them, and they didn't try to put him into jail because it would be so hard to prove, and he was gone anyway, so at least they didn't get sued.
Mm.
He had a lot of gall to sue the company for that.
I would think so.
And I guess the state cut his workman's compensation off too, because he got it illegally.
Mm.
Another one was Alligator Ridge, which we built the heap leach plant, and at the dedication where they had the governor of Nevada give a speech, and there were other speeches, and I was standing, and they had, you know, they had food and beer and all kinds of soft drinks and everything, and there were a couple of hundred people there, and I was standing talking with a man by the name of Don Koza, K-O-Z-A, who was the manager of the gold plant down in Pioche, Nevada, P-I-O-C-H-E, and who I'd known. And there was a bunch of guards, security people around. There were half a dozen of them, and they had pretty sky blue uniforms on, brand new. And Don started to laugh, and I said, what are you laughing at? And he said, you see those two guards over there in the pretty uniforms? And I said, yeah. And he said, I fired them for stealing 2 months ago.
Uh-oh.
And it turned out that about 4 months later, they found that these guards had been stealing gold. They were head of a ring of about six people that had been stealing actually carbon, loaded carbon from the carbon in pulp or carbon in the leach plant, and they had been they caught them, and I think one of them went to jail, the chief of security. I don't think the other ones did. But you see, with carbon, normally you'd like to keep the concentration of gold in the carbon that absorbs the gold from the cyanide solution. You like to keep it fairly low, because, and some people don't. I don't know why these gold companies are so casual about these things. But I've seen a number of companies that load their carbon to as much as 500 ounces of gold per ton. And if you load it to 500 ounces of gold per ton, then 1 pound of carbon contains a quarter of an ounce of gold. And you can put a pound of carbon in your pocket, and that's $75 worth. And they can take it home and just burn off the carbon and recover the gold. It's amazing that these carbon plants, they very seldom have screens over the carbon columns. And the carbon is very easy to steal. They don't check these people, and even so, if they would check them occasionally they'll check them with a magnetometer, but that won't show up on a magnetometer, because the gold is in the form of gold cyanide, which isn't magnetic at all. And well, gold is not magnetic either. And this is in foreign countries when you have laborers that work for $2, $3, $4, $5 a day, and they steal a pound of carbon that's worth $75, the temptation is extremely high.
Of course it is.
And here in the United States, when these operators are making $40,000 a year, the temptation is less, but it's still a temptation, and there is still gold, a lot of gold stolen. Very often, when you have a theft, it involves the security people that they hire. Because they are not paid very much. They're paid not much more than minimum wage. And so that they are susceptible to temptation.
Just a second, Bob.